watch his beloved sports movies, the job fell to me. Truth told, I loved a rainy afternoon watching movies with my dad, and I relax into Cassidy's couch as the movie flashes back to the 60s, showing a neighborhood baseball scene on the small screen. I'm so into the movie for the first 15 or 20 minutes, in fact, taking handfuls of popcorn on autopilot, that when my hand brushes against Cassidy's in the bowl, I'm jolted back to the reality of where I am. And with whom? My heart flutters as I yank my hand away. Sorry.
It's okay,
he says. And when I glance over at him, his lips are trembling in the bluish glow of the TV, like maybe he's trying not to laugh. What?
Are you nervous?
A little, I admit. He gives me side eyes.
Which one of us has never been on a date to the movies? You or me?
Don't overestimate me, I say. This all feels pretty new to me right about now.
Good,
he says, picking up the bowl and putting it on his left side so there's nothing between us anymore.
Because I have no idea what I'm doing.
He slides next to me until our hips are flush.
I've seen the yawn, stretch, arm around the shoulder move in other movies, you know. I guess I could give it a try.
Unless you're actually tired, I say, grinning up at him, you can skip the yawn. On one hand, I'm accustomed to him touching me. I mean, Cassidy and I have already been physically intimate to a certain degree. He carried me on his back. He's undressed me, bathed me, stitched me, and slept beside me. But this is different, and we both know it. This is deliberate. Any time we touch each other from now isn't about caregiving or comfort. It's about want. It's about need. It's about sex. So when he raises his arm and settles it around my shoulders, my breath hitches. And as the warm, heavy weight of his palm lands on my shoulder, I am so turned on suddenly. I wish we weren't at the beginning of the movie. Damn it, but I wish we were at the end. He squeezes just a little, pulling me closer, and I shift left on the nubby brown couch so that I'm leaning against him. I draw my feet up onto the cushion and put my head on his chest, just below his shoulder. When I glance up at him, he's completely focused on the movie, so I look back at the small screen, forcing myself to calm down and concentrate on the movie. And little by little, I do. Until my heart's beating normally and my attention is focused on the story of a little boy who moves to a new neighborhood and makes friends playing baseball. Well, until the pool scene. As I realize what's coming, I'm hyper aware of Cassidy sitting beside me. We're about to watch the scene where one of the boys fakes drowning so that the lifeguard he's crushing on will give him CPR and he can steal his first kiss.
I love this part, he says, reaching for the popcorn bowl and offering it to me.
No thanks, I whisper, staring at the TV, my entire body on high alert.
Do you remember your first kiss?
I nod. Of course.
When was it?
I was 14. He walked me home after a track meet.
And kissed you.
I realize that Cassidy's staring at me, his gaze searing as I continue to watch the movie. Mm-hmm.
They say you never forget your first kiss.
You don't, I murmur. My skin is flushing everywhere, and I can't hear the movie anymore. I can't concentrate on it. I can't concentrate on anything except for Cassidy beside me and what's about to happen between us.
Bryn,
he says.
Look at me.
I do. I turn my neck to look up at him, and his eyes are so wide and so dark they look black in the soft ambient light. They drop to my mouth, holding there for a long moment before sliding back up my face. He searches my eyes, as though giving me a final chance to push him away, then pulls me closer so that the tips of my breasts brush against his chest.
"I'm calling my shot," he says.
I whimper softly, my lips parting in invitation. He looks back at my mouth, wetting his lips with his tongue, then leans closer, his nose brushing mine as he bends his head to claim my bottom lip between his. I close my eyes, arching my back to be closer to him as one of his hands reaches up to cup my jaw, his thumb under my ear, holding my face to his. His lips alternate between kissing my top, then bottom lip, claiming them each individually, sucking, kissing, stealing my breath as the arm around my waist holds me tighter. His lips depart, but his forehead rests on mine and his nose nuzzles mine gently. I breathe him in, delirious with his taste and touch, with the smell of him, the almost unbridled strength of him. For a moment, I think we're done, but he surprises me by leaning forward and pressing his lips to mine again. I moan into his mouth, relieved because I want more. Gently, I swipe my tongue over his lips and feel him jolt against me, a low groan rumbling in his throat as his tongue slides against mine. The pressure of his thumb under my ear increases, his fingers curling into the base of my skull as I seal my lips over his, sliding onto his lap and threading my fingers into his hair. My knees dig into the couch on either side of his hips, and behind me I can hear the song "This Magic Moment" playing in the movie, which is the perfect soundtrack for what's happened between us. Deep inside, something that had almost given up on life knows for sure that it is completely, vibrantly alive again, and my heart laughs because I barely remember happiness like this. But it's here, and it's now, and it's Cassidy holding me in his arms and kissing me for the first time. His tongue dances with mine, touching, sliding, warm and wet, setting off fireworks inside me as I arch my breasts into his chest and feel his erection between us, hard and throbbing at the apex of my shorts, straining against his jeans. We should stop. I know we should stop because this is his first experience with a woman, and this kiss has gone much farther than most first kisses go. But we're not kids walking home from a track meet. He's a man, and I'm a woman, and every cell in my body screams for more of him. So I kiss him some more, swallowing his groans of pleasure, the hairs on my arm at attention when he growls into my mouth, his hands dropping to my ass and pushing my groin flush against his hardness. And finally, when we've missed 20 minutes of the movie, I wrap my arms around his neck and slide my cheek against his until my forehead rests in the curve of his collarbone. His breathing is fierce and choppy in my ear, and I smile as tears well in my eyes. My last kiss for so long was with Jem. Now my last kiss belongs to Cassidy. His arms move to clasp me against him, and he holds me as we catch our breath, our hearts flush and pounding relentlessly.
Bryn,
he murmurs, his breath kissing my throat. I laugh softly, pressing my lips to his neck before leaning up to look into his eyes. They are spellbound and tender, aching with something so beautiful, so inexplicable, all I can do is stare back. All I can hope is that he looks at me like this every day for the next 2 weeks, so that when I am back in my lonely home, I remember what it felt like to be loved by Cassidy. "Now you've had your first kiss," I say, grinning at his slick, pouty lips.
"And I'll never forget it," he says.
But his tone is different from mine, less playful, more like a vow, like he's promising me something important. Suddenly my self-consciousness kicks in as I realize I'm straddling his lap, pressing my breasts against his chest with rock-hard, beaded nipples digging into his abs. I lean to the left and let gravity pull my leg back over, sitting back on the couch and settling into his side where I was watching the movie before we got carried away. "Are you sleeping in my bed tonight?" I ask him as I stare at the screen.
"No."
I whip my neck to look up at him, and he glances down at me, gesturing to the prominent bulge under the zipper of his jeans.
"I've got no self-control with you, Bryn. I want everything now."
I'm about to tell him that's fine with me when he continues speaking.
"But I'm not getting you pregnant, and I don't have protection."
Part of me is shocked that he knows about condoms. I don't know why, because I'm sure his mother or grandfather taught him the basics of sex ed, but still, it surprises me that he should be so thoughtful. "You could pull out," I suggest, instantly embarrassed by the words because they sound so desperate in my ears.
"No,"
he says, shaking his head and looking away from me, back at the movie. His jaw is tight and his face is drawn, like he's angry with me or in some serious discomfort.
"That's not an option."
I nod, wanting to respect his decision, regardless of the ache between my legs. I could feel him pressing against me, thick and hard, when I was straddling him. The practical side of my brain reminds me that I haven't been with anyone since Jem, and what's waiting for me behind Cassidy's zipper didn't feel average size. Maybe a few days to get better acquainted isn't such a bad idea after all. Still, I feel a little deprived, and I cross my arms over my chest and huff out a breath as we sit side by side, hot and bothered, pretending to watch the movie.
"Bryn."
"Hmm?"
"I said I wasn't going to sleep with you tonight."
"I heard you."
"But Angel."
I look up at him, because the way he calls me Angel makes me want to die a little. It's so reverent and tender. "What?"
"I plan on kissing you until this movie's over."
My mouth opens to an O, and I stare at him as he slips his hands under my arms and pulls me back onto his lap, cradling me there.
"Any objections?"
he asks, locking his eyes with mine as his lips draw closer. "None," I sigh, letting my Cass have his way with me.
Chapter 24. Cassidy. Whatever I thought it would be like to kiss a woman, it's all been blown to bits with two nights of Bryn straddling my lap on the couch while we devour each other's mouths, our bodies pressed close and our breath mingling. She belongs to me in ways now that I couldn't possibly fathom. She owns a part of me that is already gone, that I can never ever reclaim again. Exploring the sweet, soft recesses of her mouth while her fingers curl into my scalp, I have claimed her and surrendered to her at once. Everything is Bryn, and I am addicted to everything. She is air and water, smiles and soft sighs as she falls asleep in my arms. She is heat and warmth. She is promise and hope. She is normalcy and company and my temporary talisman against loneliness. She moves like the air or the dark surrounding me, inside me, of the world and yet belonging intimately and particularly to me. She is everything I want that I can't have, more and more necessary for survival, which means it will destroy me when I let her go. I know this, and yet I cannot slow down or take less. I love her. I will love her until the sky falls, until the sun and moon fail to rise, until Katahdin crumbles. I will love her forever. She grins at me over her shoulder as she collects eggs from the girls, and though I am milking Annie, it occurs to me to leap over the stool I'm sitting on and grab her around the waist, hauling her against my body to kiss her until she's limp and sighing. When she smiles, even I, damned from my very conception, cursed from the cradle, feel my heart soar. That's how it is with angels, I'm learning. I bet the devil couldn't stay away if he tried. I watch her. I memorize her. I drink her in, the way her dark hair caresses her cheek until she sweeps it behind her ear, the way her eyes sparkle when she peeks up at me and giggles, the way her breasts rise and fall with every breath she takes, Her bare feet crackle softly on the hay that covers the hard wooden floor of the barn, and I am drawn even to them, in love with them, jealous of them, hating them a little because they will take her away from me. Except I can't hate her or anything about her. I would die to keep one of those toes safe. My broken Bryn, in pieces when I found her, seems to be more and more whole every day, and I fall harder and deeper for this sweet, gentle woman every moment I spend with her. What? Huh? I mutter, grinning at her because I am a man in love, foolish with tenderness, unable to help himself. You're just staring at me like crazy. I tug on Annie's teat, and a stream of milk spits into my metal bucket. Maybe because I'm crazy about you, Angel. She freezes, and her eyes widen as she stares at me. You are? I give her a look. You know I am. Then why can't we? She's about to ask me why our days together must be finite, but she catches herself before the words leave her mouth. Over the past 2 days, my Bryn has more than once wanted to push our agreed-on boundaries to include a discussion of our feelings for each other, or an extension on our time together. But she has stopped herself every time. I clench my jaw, telling myself that I shouldn't lead her on with statements like, "I'm crazy about you," no matter how right they feel falling from my lips. We have agreed to a physical relationship with each other. Nothing else. Are you still going to the store tomorrow? She asks, her cheeks pinkening as she finds an egg under Stacy and places it gingerly in the wire basket. The store. The store where I will buy a box of condoms for the rest of our time together. Yeah, I say, my voice tight as I stand up abruptly, eliciting an annoyed "ma" from Annie. Sex. Aside from Bryn, it's all I think about lately. When we finally untangle our fully clothed bodies from each other every night, heading to our separate rooms, my body aches for hers so painfully. I've had to get myself off outside under a freezing cold midnight shower. It barely helps, though. My entire being is a magnet drawn to hers, and nothing will feed the hunger until I am buried inside her. Twice since the Sandlot, I've looked at the pictures in my magazines, not to appease my longing or slake my thirst, but because I want to be sure I understand what to do. I can't lie. I'm nervous about my lack of experience, and the bounty of hers. I can't promise that I'll be smooth when we finally make love, but damn it, I want to get it as right as possible. For her, and frankly, for me, so that when she compares me with other men years and years from now, I will have some small chance of holding my own in her memories. It's wrong, I know, but I am desperate that she remember me. Sometimes it's the only thought that gives me strength when contemplating my lonely future, that after the time we've spent together, I will always be a part of her. You know, she says, her voice warm and flirtatious, as she leans her elbows on the split rail that separates Annie's stall from the girl's coop. We should have a picnic at the pond today. Yeah? She nods, a smile, possibly a little frost, brightening her beautiful face. Doesn't that sound nice? Sunshine, warm day, soft blanket? Willing woman? Willing woman. She's going to kill me. I put my hands on the rail on either side of her elbows. Do you swim, Ms. Cadogan? Swim? Of course. You've been complaining about your hair for a few days now, I say, so close to her that I could drop my lips to hers. How about you let me wash it? She gasps, her eyes widening. Cass, I'd give anything. Anything, I grind out. Anything but... Her lips close, but lightly, and she tilts her head. Don't you see? Everything's already yours. Kill me dead. I reach for her cheeks, cupping her face as I find her lips with mine. It's not that I'm used to the taste and texture of them, but she is familiar to me now, and I sink into the feeling of her, irritated by the fence between us. Instinctively, I want to feel the heat of her body pressed against mine as my tongue tangles with hers. She moans, and the sound shoots straight to my groin, where my pecker swells with a rush of blood, hardening in my jeans. I try to pull her closer but can't, and finally I break off the kiss out of frustration. "The pond," I pant. She nods, her green eyes black. "The pond." As we walk through the meadow to the pond, holding hands, I think about what I found in the back of my closet while looking for the swim trunks I haven't used in years. It's a camera, my mother's old Polaroid, and it has 3 pictures left inside. I put it in the bottom of a bag holding a blanket, 2 towels, and a bottle of shampoo, and now I'm wondering how smart an idea that was. I mean, of course I want a picture of Bryn, but will that picture drive me to madness once she's gone? Wouldn't it be better just to live on faded memories? "Your mom was smaller than me." The sun is high in the sky and the tall grasses sway in a lazy afternoon breeze as Bryn looks up at me. "Huh?" I glance down at her, wearing my mother's old navy blue bathing suit and a pair of denim shorts. The stretchy material strains over her breasts, dipping so low it barely covers her nipples. "It's a good thing we're all alone out here," I think, "because what's under that suit is mine, and I wouldn't want another man ogling her." "Up top," says Bryn, patting her chest with a free palm. "She was smaller than me." "Yeah," I nod. "She was tiny." "Was she sick for a long time?" I think back to the way she kept to her bed more and more, always tired, that worried look in her eyes increasing as the months went on. "For about a year. It went fast."
"Did you take care of her?"
"Grandpa and I both did."
"She never stayed at a hospital?"
"No. She went to a doctor toward the end, but it was too late to do much for her by then."
"Cancer, right?"
I nod.
"How did your dad—"
"Almost there," I say, cutting her off. "Did I mention I found a camera?"
"What? A camera? You did?"
"Uh-huh," I say, squeezing her hand, grateful her attention's been diverted. "An old Polaroid."
"Ha, they're back in style now, you know."
"Really?"
"Yeah, teens love them. They're smaller now and come in all different colors, but yeah, they're really popular. Everything old becomes new again, doesn't it?"
"I wouldn't know. Everything old just is." "There's not much film left in it," I say.
"Enough for a selfie?"
"A selfie?"
"You know," she says, grinning up at me. "We put our cheeks together, hold the camera away from our faces, smile, and click. Voila."
"A selfie," I say, nodding now that I understand. "Yeah, I guess we do. There are 3 pictures left.
One of Cass, one of Bryn, one selfie," she says in a sing-song voice.
Bryn has a pretty voice. Once or twice while I was playing the Beatles on Graham's old guitar, she'd hum along, and I tried to sing softer so I could hear her. "We could have a campfire tomorrow night," I suggest. "I'll get out my guitar."
"Sounds good."
"Will you sing?"
She nods. "If you play the Beatles, I will."
"Then I'll play the Beatles," I say as we clear the woods and find ourselves at Harrington Pond. "Why don't we spread out the blanket on your rock?"
"My rock?"
she says, smiling up at me, squinting her eyes at the sun. I kiss her sweet lips once, twice, 3 times before kissing the tip of her nose. "Bryn's rock."
"Bryn's Cass,"
she murmurs, her voice husky, her lips moving against my cheek. The 2 simple words make something inside me clench hard, and it's almost painful, like a swift kick to the gut. "Not for long. Not for long." "Yeah," I mumble. I drop her hand and walk through the tall grass, over to the large flat rock. I spread out Mama's favorite red plaid wool blanket. "Want to have lunch first?" She lifts the picnic basket and hands it to me.
"No."
"Not hungry?"
"Since you mentioned washing my hair this morning, I can barely think about anything else." "Please,"
she sighs with longing, and my pecker jumps in my swim trunks. "Yeah,"
I say, turning back to the bag to take out the shampoo. Let's wash it. When I turn around, she's pulling Mama's shorts down her creamy white legs. She steps out of them and throws them to me. Last one in is a rotten egg. Giggling, she runs into the pond, jumping in and submerging her head almost immediately, though I know it's gotta be cold. Glacier-made ponds in northern Maine are rarely warm, even in July. When her head bobs up, she's gasping, but still laughing. I reach behind my neck and tug my t-shirt over my head. Then, holding the bottle of shampoo in my hand, I jump from the rock into the pond. It's cold as heck, but refreshing on such a sunny day. And I rise to the surface laughing, just like Bryn. From where we are, still relatively close to the shore, we can both stand. I hold up the bottle. Ready? Droplets of water cling to her lashes as she walks toward me. Bottom's squishy. Turning away, she backs up against me, no doubt feeling the push of my erection in her back. I can't help feeling turned on. She's practically naked, and I'm about to touch her. Oh, she hums, her voice merry as she rubs her bottom against me. Someone's not very affected by the cold. I clench my jaw, put one hand on her shoulder to make her stop. You want your hair washed or not? She giggles again, taking a step forward so I'm no longer fondling her back with my jutting length. Yes, Cassidy, I want my hair washed. I pour shampoo into my hand, tuck the bottle under my arm, then reach for her scalp, working the soap into a small lather. She leans her head back, moaning softly. I put another handful of soap into my palms and rub it into her hair, taking care to pull it through the strands, gently digging my fingers into her scalp and behind her ears. Cass, she hums, her eyes closed, her face drinking in the sun. I pull the bottle from under my arm and toss it onto the shore. Then I go back to work, gathering her dark hair in my hands and massaging her scalp with my fingers. Mmm, she sighs, the soft moan of pleasure competing with the gentle ripple of water and the summer song of the cicadas. I lean down close to her ear and murmur, time to rinse. She leans back, her neck straining, and I guide her head into the water, running my fingers through the clean hair from her forehead to the tips, then back again. There's something incredibly intimate about servicing her like this, knowing that her gasps and moans of pleasure are because of me, that I am bringing that sort of satisfaction to her. Knowing that I can pleasure her makes me feel a little godlike, frankly, because she is my angel, the closest thing to heaven I have ever encountered. The last of the soap floats away, and she leans up slowly, finally standing in front of me, her back to my chest. I watch, holding my breath, as she skims her hands up to her shoulders. She hooks her fingers under the straps of the bathing suit, then slides them down her arms, over her elbows, pulling her hands through the openings, first one, then the other. The suit is peeled down to her waist, hidden under the water, leaving her back naked to me. She reaches behind, feeling through the water to find my hands at my sides. Taking them in hers, she steps back, her lower back flush against my throbbing erection. My breath catches as she leans her head on my chest, then raises my hands to her breasts, covering her flesh with my palms. Her nipples are hard, like little pebbles covered in velvet, and I move my hands experimentally, cupping the soft, wet mounds of sweet flesh as she closes her eyes and exhales on a soft moan. Her breath is ragged and choppy as she reaches up with one arm to pull my head down to hers. But when she leans up and our lips connect, she steals all my breath to fill her lungs. Turning slowly in my arms until her chest presses against mine, she kisses me hungrily. I slide my hands down her wet skin, over the bunched-up fabric of her bathing suit to her backside, lifting her up. As she does on the couch every night, she straddles my waist, locking her feet above my hip bone and cradling my hard length between her thighs. The stiff points of her naked breasts rub against my chest as she winds her arms around my neck and holds on. My penis throbs between us, pressure building as she arches against me, moving her hips rhythmically against my arousal, the silken slide of her warm, wet tongue unbelievably erotic against mine. Every nerve ending in my body is firing as this sweet woman moans into my mouth, and suddenly I can't hold back anymore. I let go, My orgasm rocks through my body, making me growl and release as I clasp her against me, as ribbons of my hot release jet from my body in spurts, gathering in my swim trunks. I am shuddering against her even as I hold her, and she nuzzles my face tenderly.
Good?
She asks softly. So good, I answer, the last of my shudders fading. I open my eyes to find her smiling at me.
Sleep in my bed tonight?
She asks. I shake my head. If anything, what just happened is proof that I have zero control around her. I won't risk it. I can't. Tomorrow. She unclasps her feet from my waist and lowers them back to the pond bottom, looking up at me, her green eyes deep and lovely, if a little disappointed.
Thank you for washing my hair.
Thank you for... My eyes drop to her breasts, and though I peeked at them a couple of weeks ago, now I stare at them hungrily, with permission, without shame. They are full and pert, with pink nipples that beckon to me. I want to taste them, to kiss them like I do her lips. Lowering my head, I cup the right breast, plumping it between my hands, then dip my lips to taste her. Her skin is warm from the sun, but cool from the lake, and the already hardened nipple puckers between my lips. I lave it with my tongue, letting instinct take over as she plunges her hands into my hair, drawing me closer with a gasp and groan. Swirling my tongue around the erect bud, I run my thumb back and forth over its twin before skimming my lips across her chest and sucking it into my mouth, too.
Cass,
she cries softly. I experiment with a little more pressure, sucking greedily, and she whimpers sharply, pushing my head away. I rest my forehead in the curve of her neck, opening my eyes, not certain if I've done something wrong.
No more,
she murmurs, out of breath, her pulse hammering in her throat. She forces my head up and kisses my lips, then speaks against them.
It can be too much.
Bad? I whisper, frozen, worried that I might have hurt her.
No, love. Wonderful.
She says, drawing back to look up at me. Her lips are puffy from kissing, and her eyes are dilated and wide. I don't know if she's ever looked so beautiful.
But I want more.
Ah, this I understand. Tomorrow, I say.
Tomorrow.
With a nod of her head, she gestures to our blanket on the rock as she pulls up the straps of the bathing suit, covering herself.
Hungry?
Always, Bryn. Always. As though reading my mind, she shakes her head and grins at me like I'm being naughty. I've never experienced this sort of flirting before, and I laugh at her expression because I love it. She takes my hand and pulls me back to shore. And I follow.
Chapter 25. Bryn. After yesterday's hot frolic in the pond, I felt Cassidy's hungry eyes on me for the rest of the afternoon, and today, over breakfast, too. As he drives away on his ATV after his morning chores, headed for the store, my heart grows tendrils unfurling toward him, straining to be with him even as the sound of the motor fades into the distance. Finally, I turn around and climb up the steps to sit on one of the three rockers on the front porch. Maybe I'll just rock here until he returns and try to process everything going on between us. My mind is spinning. We want each other with a longing that's starting to border on desperation, and for the first time in my life, I'm wondering why there isn't a female counterpart of Blue Balls. I love the attention, of course. The way he makes me feel like the most delectable, desirable woman in creation, and I have certainly never wanted a man so much in my entire life as I want Cassidy Porter. That said, my poor heart is counting down the days. With only 10 left, I'm not sure how I can bear it. Losing Jem almost broke me, but Jem is gone, and there's no way he'll ever be back. He isn't alive somewhere on the earth living his life without me. He isn't an option, and making my life a shrine to him isn't what he would have wanted. It isn't what I want either. I want to live, and I want love. I want Cassidy. When I leave him in a week and a half, in the back of my mind, I'll know that he's alive. He's living and breathing somewhere on the earth without me. Without me. Little by little, day by day, that's what will break me, knowing he's out there, alive and well, and I can't have him. And why not? Why can't I have him? I push off from the floor, rocking the chair angrily and thinking back to the two times that Cassidy has ever yelled at me. The first was when we were reading on the couch and I asked him if he was lonely, if he wanted a girlfriend or a wife. His answer hadn't been ambiguous, nor did it leave room for interpretation. I'm just not much of a people person, I guess, he said, and when I pressed, he snapped at me. I don't need anyone. My mind segues to our conversation in the kitchen when he removed my stitches. Not unlike the other time, he totally shut down when I tried to talk about feelings, yelling at me to stop. Later in the conversation, he made it clear that although he liked me, he wasn't interested in changing his life, that he liked his life the way it was. Essentially the same sentiment he'd shared before. It's a hot button, for sure, Cassidy allowing someone into his life. We can't even talk about it without him yelling at me and shutting down. And that vehemence should convince me he's telling the truth, right? Except it doesn't, because I've always believed that actions speak louder than words, and Cassidy's actions speak about him caring for me, enjoying me, maybe even starting to love me a little. He claims to feel one way about his solitary life, but he sinks into my company, seeking out my presence, spending all his time with me, holding me like I'm the most precious person in his world. So I'm confused by the disconnect. He says he doesn't need anyone, doesn't want anyone, but it seems like, it feels like he needs and wants, well, me. I keep rocking, the movement soothing and good for thinking. Why would he say something that wasn't true? Why must I leave when I am well and able? Why can't we be together for a little longer? Or a lot longer, if that's what we want? I can't help but wonder if his reluctance to be with me, or indeed to change his life, has something to do with why he and his mother left the town and moved out here in the first place. Frustrated that I don't have access to the internet, where I could surf their names, birth records, death records, and newspaper articles, I decide to get a little old-fashioned. Maybe I can piece together Cassidy's history a different way. There's got to be something inside the cabin that could tell me why he and his mother left town, why he chooses to live this lonely existence so far from humanity. I head into the house. He won't be back for a few hours, so I beeline to his room at the end of the hall. It's small and tidy, with a twin bed, a nightstand, a bureau, a closet, and a door to the outside. I lean down, opening the first drawer of his bureau, then the second, then the third. But even when I carefully push around his neatly folded clothes, I don't find anything hidden in the backs of the drawers. Turning to his closet, I realize that I can't reach the top shelf, so I get a chair from the kitchen and drag it back to his room. I step up on it and look at the top shelf, where, presumably, he found his mother's Polaroid camera. There are winter clothes, a neatly folded parka and snow pants, plus all manner of gloves, mittens, and hats, in a plastic laundry basket. Feeling around behind the clothes, I find nothing out of the ordinary, until my fingers touch a metal box. I pull it gently from the piles of clothes and carefully step down from the chair to take a better look. I sit on Cass's bed and open the top, peering down at the contents. On top is a folded piece of paper, which, when I unfold it, reveals a set of four photo booth pictures of a little boy and a 30-something woman, cheek to cheek and all smiles. I recognize Cassidy and his mother instantly and stare at his mom's kind blue eyes and frizzy blonde hair. She is homely. Her front teeth are badly bucked, and she doesn't wear any makeup, but her smile tells me how much she loves her son, and his smile tells me how much he loves her back. Setting the photo aside, I pluck a leather bracelet from the box and hold it up. Burned into the leather is the name Cassidy, uneven and jagged, like he made it by himself. Under the bracelet, I find another photo, this time of a little boy and a grown man standing side by side in a park about a foot from each other. The man, who is different from the man I saw in the portrait over the sofa, towers over the boy. He stares intently into the camera with his arms crossed over his chest. The little boy does the same, his mouth a flat, grim line. Neither looks especially happy or comfortable. I flip over the picture and read, Paul and Cass, Father-Son Cookout, 1995. Paul, his father, about whom he never speaks, who died when he was 9. I flip over the picture again and look at the man more carefully, the way he wears his hair slicked to the side and his heavy black-rimmed glasses. His shirt is buttoned all the way to the top and tucked into belted jeans. As I squint at his face, something about him feels familiar, though I don't necessarily note a resemblance between father and son. Then again, I think, tilting my head, Cassidy is very tall, like his father. But his father appears to have had brown eyes, while Cassidy's are blue and green. I stare at the photo for an extra moment, feeling unsettled, then add it to the strip of photos and the bracelet beside me on the bed. I find a few more things in the bottom of the box. 3 marbles, some dirty coins, an empty turtle shell, a Lego sheriff holding a revolver, and a Lego Indian chief with a scratched face. Nothing out of the ordinary. Just little boy things that any normal child might keep in a box of treasures. Carefully placing the keepsakes back where I found them, I put the top back on the box and step on the chair to return it to its spot in the back of the closet. I am no closer to answers than before I went snooping. I close the closet door and leave Cass's room, putting the chair back at the kitchen table and feeling a little ashamed of myself for violating his privacy. And I must consider, as painful as it is to contemplate, that there isn't some major traumatic reason for Cassidy's lack of interest in a relationship with me. As tears blur my eyes, I think about his words over the several weeks we've been together. I'm content with things the way they are. My life works. I'm not looking to change it. He's been honest with me from the very start. He doesn't want a girlfriend or a wife. And while he might welcome my company temporarily, he doesn't want me in any sort of real way. Feeling quietly miserable, I walk through the living room to my bedroom and crawl under the covers. Sometimes, when I look into his eyes, I feel like I see love there. But it's not love, Bryn. It's care. It's kindness, momentary tenderness, desire. But don't fool yourself. It's not permanent. It's about now, not forever. Stupid girl that I am, I have fallen in love with him. Utterly, totally, completely in love with him. And all I want is a forever that I cannot have.
Bryn, I'm back.
My eyes are still heavy and burn from the tears I cried before falling asleep. I open them to find Cassidy's face close to mine and the light in the room fading. It must be late afternoon, which means I've been asleep for hours. Hi, I say.
You okay?
He asks, his brows furrowing as he places the back of his hand on my forehead.
You look a little funny.
I'm fine, I say. I was just feeling a little emotional about everything.
Everything?
Being with you? I smile sadly. Leaving you? He flinches, and it's a tiny movement, but I catch it. Confusion darts through me, scrambling the equations I thought I had worked out before. Does the idea of me leaving hurt him? He drops my eyes, turning away, looking up at Katahdin through the picture windows. Apparently, we're not going to discuss it, and if I lie here pouting, I will ruin the time we have left together. I'm not willing to do that, so I sit up and muster a smile. Did you get everything? He looks at me and nods.
Also,
he reaches into his pocket and pulls out a strip of leather.
I got you this.
I reach for it, staring down at the simple, braided bracelet in cinnamon-colored leather. It has two drawstring cords sticking out from the ends that will tighten it on my wrist when pulled at the same time. I love it. At first sight. For me. He reaches for my wrist, then takes the bracelet and slips it over my hand, pulling the cords until it's snug. Then he looks up at me.
I never bought a present for a girl before.
You did good, I say, cupping his cheek. Lots of firsts for you lately. His eyes, so different and singular, scan my face, finally dropping to my lips. He leans forward, pressing his mouth to mine gently. I pull him down to me, thanking him for the bracelet and trying to let him know how grateful I am for everything he's done for me. And yes, how much I wish there was the possibility of a future for us. I swipe the seam of our lips with the tip of my tongue, and he jolts, wrapping his arms around me and hauling me onto his lap. Cradled against his chest, I meet his tongue with mine, my thoughts starting to scatter as instinct takes over. My muscles tense and release, longing for his thickness within me, priming themselves to grip him as he slides inside. Cassidy breaks off the kiss and leans his forehead against mine, panting softly.
I sort of want it.
I open my eyes, ignoring the throbbing deep inside and focusing on what he's about to say. What?
I was thinking I could take you on a date tonight.
A date? You mean go out? He kisses my nose, then leans away.
No. Here. Have a date here.
What did you have in mind?
Do you trust me?
And the thing is, I do. Completely. Even with my stupid heart, which will be shattered beyond repair 2 weeks from now, I trust him. I still hope that there will be a happy ending for us, even though I can't fathom it now. You saved my life. He grins at me and nods.
I did.
More than once.
It's one of my specialties.
I giggle, because the cocky, playful side of Cassidy is adorable. Okay, so you didn't answer my question. What did you have in mind?
Oh, no, you didn't answer me. Do you trust me?
Yes, I pout, but I still want to know. He takes a deep breath and purses his lips, like he's considering telling me, but at the last minute he shakes his head.
Nope, you're just going to have to wait.
For what?
I guess you better get ready,
he tells me in a sing-song voice that I sometimes use with him. I can't help it. I feel excited, wondering what he's got planned. Another movie? Skinny dipping after dark. My mind segues to the condoms he bought. Surely sex is figuring into the equation, right? Are you romancing me to get in my pants, Cassidy Porter? I ask, grinning at him. He shrugs, smiling down at me, two pink spots appearing in his cheeks.
Maybe.
You don't have to. I say simply, because it's true. This man owns my heart and my body, and I suspect, before I leave him, he will own my soul as well. Gems is up on Katahdin. Mine will be forever with Cassidy.
I want to,
he says, his eyes serious.
You deserve to be romanced.
Oh, my heart. Okay, then. What do I need to do? He looks around the room, his eyes resting for a moment on the trunk beside the bureau. I've ignored it, assuming it held extra blankets like the trunk at the foot of my bed at home, but now I wonder if there's something more inside.
Choose something to wear and get ready. I'll pick you up in an hour.
Pick me up?
At your door. Curtain. I'm a gentleman.
I chuckle, nodding at him. And we're just staying here? He nods, looking around the room, his eyes serious when they land on mine.
We're staying here, Angel. All night long.
He kisses the top of my head and leaves me alone, and I know that the days are dwindling, and I know my heart is going to hurt when it's over. But I refuse to kill the now, grieving an unlikely forever. I smile to myself, excited for our date, and jump out of bed to open Mrs. Porter's trunk to see what's inside.
Chapter 26. Cassidy. I've read enough books and seen enough TV shows and movies to know that a first date is a big deal, and though nothing about our relationship has been conventional, this is one thing that I'd really like to get right. When I was at the store today, aside from picking up a ridiculous number of condom boxes, 6 to be exact, which was all they had in stock, I bought some citronella candles, wine, cheese, 2 steaks, and batteries for my transistor radio. I can pick up WSYY-FM in Millinocket on a clear night, and this one is going to be about as clear as it gets. I also picked up some marshmallows, chocolate bars, and graham crackers because I promised Bryn a campfire, and it would be a shame to have one without s'mores. I moved the kitchen table outside on the grass, and I've covered it with an old tablecloth and set it proper-like with plates, napkins, and wine glasses. It's blues night on the radio, which is fine with me, and the candles flicker cheerfully in the evening breeze. I took an outdoor shower and shaved my beard, then slipped in through the outside door of my room to get dressed. I'm wearing clean jeans, a white t-shirt, and a plaid flannel, because there's a nip in the air tonight. There's still a little time before I have to pick up Bryn, so I pour the wine and uncover the sliced cheddar I bought at the store. Mostly, I'm feeling excited, but the way I'm bouncing around tells me that I've got some nervous energy going on, too. I want to sleep with Bryn tonight. I'm ready to give my virginity to her, but I want it to be good for her, too. I can't tell her I love her because I can't keep her here, and sharing feelings like that would make it harder for her to go. But when we sleep together later tonight, that's exactly what it will be. Lovemaking. I've never loved anyone. Not Mama, not Gramp, not anyone. As much as I love her. I turn away from the house and face Katahdin. Behind the summit, the sky is a riot of color, which airbrushes the clouds in a way that feels otherworldly. Garish orange, intense purple, delicate lavender. Baxter Peak isn't a pitched peak like you'd see in a child's drawing of a mountain. It's smoothed out and mellow, the highest point at a little over 5,200 feet. Compare this with Jagged Everest, which stands at almost 30,000 feet. But Katahdin's been around for 400 million years, created when an archipelago collided with the continent of North America, whereas Yungan Everest was formed a mere 60 million years ago. Katahdin might be an old lady, but she holds her own. The most experienced climbers in the world have come away from Katahdin calling her a beast, and for whatever reason, that makes me proud. Most important of all, she brought Bryn to me, and for that I will be forever grateful. That said, however, lately I've started to wonder how I will bear living here once Bryn is gone. As I drove to and from the store this morning, I thought that when she leaves, maybe it's time for me to leave for a while, too. Maybe not forever, but for a few seasons. I have more than enough money to start over somewhere else, or just travel around for a while. Not only have I lived frugally, but I've got a complete skill set for off-grid living. I could just disappear. But there will be a lifetime of hours to ponder these thoughts later. Not tonight. Tonight there's a beautiful girl inside my house, and she's waiting for me to pick her up for our date. Running a hand through my still damp hair, I grab the bouquet of wildflowers I've collected and take the porch steps in a single leap, opening the front door and striding through the living room. At the curtain that separates her room from the rest of the house, I pause, acknowledging the bubbles in my belly before knocking on the doorframe.
Anyone home? Come in. Her voice makes me smile, and I sweep open the curtain to find her sitting on the edge of the bed, looking up at me. She's wearing a light blue denim sundress that dips just over her full breasts and ends right above her knees, and an open white cardigan sweater. She wears the braided bracelet on her slim wrist, and it makes my heart swell a little because I gave it to her. Her shiny chestnut hair has been gathered in a ponytail over one shoulder and tied with a light blue ribbon, and her feet are bare. Christ, how I wish I never ever had to let her go. Hi, she says, grinning up at me. I offer her the flowers. You look beautiful. Thank you. She leans down to smell them, then looks up at me with sparkling eyes and upturned lips. Oh, Bryn, Bryn, how I love you. I've got a vase somewhere, I hear myself say. I'll track it down for you. She lays the small bouquet on the end table, stands up, and spins around. I had no idea your mom had a few more things in the trunk. Most of her dresses were too small, but I thought I could get away with this one if I wore a sweater. I take a step toward her and drink her in. I've never seen a woman as pretty as you, Bryn Cadogan. She blushes, and for just a second I feel like the king of the world, because my actions and my words somehow manage to touch her. I'm not worthy of her, but she's here, with me, her cheeks pink and her eyes tender. You shaved? She says. Gramps' old straight razor, I say, rubbing my soft jaw. You're crazy handsome, Cass. Right. No one's ever called me handsome before. Well, Mama, but Mamas don't count. They have to think their sons are handsome. She laughs, shaking her head. Scorching hot. Though I've never heard this expression before, the darkening of her eyes tells me it's a good thing to be scorching hot, and I can't help grinning down at her, my blush likely matching hers. Okay, thanks, I guess. I thought I heard music, she says, looking over my shoulder. You did. I got batteries for my radio. And was that candlelight I saw through the curtains? Yes, ma'am. And if I'm not mistaken, I heard a cork popping? I can't vouch for the vintage, but yes, I got us some wine. A candlelight dinner with music and wine, she sighs, her eyes soft and tender. Now you're spoiling me. It's because I love you, I think, but I just nod, offering her my arm. Shall we? She takes my arm with a soft chuckle, placing her hand in the crook of my elbow. Tonight is my first date, I say as I escort her across the living room and through the front door. I've been waiting for it for a long time. We step out on the porch together. I hope I got it right. She gasps when she sees our candlelit table, with the blazing campfire just behind and Katahdin in the distance. Wow, she murmurs. You nailed it. It's my turn to laugh with pleasure, loving her reaction. Yeah? Yeah. She nods, then sniffles, reaching up to swipe at her eyes. It's really beautiful. Thank you. Hey, you're crying, I say, putting my hands on her shoulders and turning her to face me. Why are you crying, Angel? You're the angel. She leans forward, sobbing against my chest, resting her cheek on my shoulder. You saved me. You breathed life back into me. Oh, Cass. Her shoulders shake under my hands, and I don't know why she's so sad, but I hate it, even though sadness is a part of the Bryn I love. Her trust in the world was stolen when her fiancé was shot, and again when she was attacked on the mountain. She has a right to her tears, and I am honored to be the person she turns to when she needs to cry. Shh, sweet girl, I murmur, sweeping her into my arms and sitting down on one of the porch rockers with her cradled on my lap. It's okay. It's gonna be all right.
It won't be, she whispers, her breath teasing my neck. I'm trying to be brave, but it will break me in half to say goodbye to you.
I force myself to swallow the sudden lump in my throat because her words mirror my feelings. Oh, God, if only we could run away. But there's no running from what I am, from who I am. It's selfish enough that I am taking these 2 weeks from her. I can't take more. I won't. But I don't want to hurt her either. I clear my throat, grimacing because the words I'm about to say taste bitter. Maybe we should stop here.
What do you mean?
Well, we don't have to go any further or make this any harder. We could, you know, end it now. This? Us?
No, Bryn, no.
We agreed to 2 weeks. I don't want to hurt you, I say, reaching up to rub away the burning in my eyes and wishing I wasn't who I am. She has been cuddled on my lap, but now she sits up and leans away from me, staring out at the mountain that was here long before us and will still be standing long after we're gone.
I'm going to be a little sad now and then, she says, because it aches to think of leaving you.
Which is why, but I want you any way I can have you, Cassidy Porter, she says, plowing over my words as she turns on my lap to look at me and raises her hands to palm my cheeks.
I don't know why you can't see the same future with me that I can imagine with you. I don't know what secrets you hold that make you think we need to be temporary, but I know that every beat of my heart happens now because you saved me. So, in a way, it belongs to you as much as it belongs to me. And whatever time I can have with you, Cass, I will not surrender it.
She kisses me passionately after this short speech, her silken tongue gliding between my lips as her fingers curl into my hair. When she pulls away, her breasts rise and fall rapidly with her panted breaths, and her eyes are as black as night.
I want the candles and the wine and the fire, but first, she says, sliding from my lap and standing before me, I want you.
Backlit by the sunset behind Katahdin, she reaches for the sweater and pushes it over her shoulders, letting it glide down her arms. Reaching behind, she unzips the dress, pulling her arms from the straps and letting it whoosh softly to the floor. She isn't wearing a bra, only white panties, and she slips her thumbs into the waistband and tugs. I watch as they sluice down her legs. She steps out of them and stands before me, naked in the dying sun.
Cass, she murmurs, her voice ragged and deep as she holds out her hand. I need you. Come with me.
I haven't dared to breathe since she said I want you, but I fill my lungs as I take her hand and stand up, following her back into the house. Her fingers twine through mine as we cross the living room and enter her room. The light of the sunset bathes the small room with ethereal warmth as she turns to face me and backs up to the bed. Holding my eyes, her hands rise to my shoulders, and she slips her fingers under my flannel shirt, smoothing her palms over my skin to slide it down my arms. Her hands flatten on my chest, then drop to the hem of my t-shirt, which she pulls up to my neck. I reach for the bunched cotton and pull it over my head, my heart racing with love and anticipation as I stare down at her. Her lips twitch with a grin as her hands skate slowly, side by side, over the ripples of my abdominal muscles. They part ways at my pelvis, and she follows the V-shaped lines of muscle and bone to the waistband of my jeans. Raising her chin just a touch, she reaches for the button at my waist and unsnaps it, then unzips my jeans. As she pushes the denim over my hips, she looks down, gasping in surprise to discover that I don't wear underwear. When I step out of my jeans, I'm as naked as she is. Without touching, we stand facing each other, our dark eyes locked. In my peripheral vision, I can see her breasts rise and fall with her breathing. No doubt she can see my erection, thick and straining, pointing straight up between us and pulsing with every beat of my heart. She is beautiful. She is offering herself to me. She is giving me something I never even allowed myself to hope for. I hear a low, guttural sob fill the room, and at first I don't realize it's me, because I'm not crying. I'm just in awe, and that's how awe sounds. I don't know how to feel this much love for someone. It hurts to love her this much. And yet I wouldn't trade this moment even to cleanse my blood of my father's poison. Every second of my life, every step and misstep, every breath, every choice, every bit of luck and grace and mercy has led me to this sacred space. If I have to be me, if I have to be Cassidy Porter, Paul Isaac Porter's son,
in order to find myself here, in this beautiful moment, with this sweet, stunning woman. Then I will own who I am. And for the very first time in my life, I am grateful to be me. Cass, she whispers, do you trust me? I nod once, slowly. Completely. Stay still, she murmurs, smoothing her hands down my arms and lowering herself to her knees before me, her back against the bed. Lowering my gaze, I watch as she gently winds her fingers around the base of my erection, then licks a trail from base to tip before taking me into the warm, wet heaven of her mouth. I cry out, my fingers fisting and releasing air, looking for somewhere to hold on. I reach for her dark hair, winding it through my fingers as I close my eyes. Her lips move slowly over the ridges of my throbbing skin, and I can feel every swipe of her tongue, every swirl, every lick. In all my life, I've never experienced anything nearly as erotic or half as sensual as this woman bathing my sex with her mouth. I close my eyes, still running my fingers through her hair, as I feel the pressure on my balls building. And suddenly I realize that I don't know what I'm supposed to do next. My eyes flare open and I take a step back, pulling back my hips, my pecker disconnecting from her gorgeous lips with a loud pop. Her neck snaps back, and she looks up at me with wide, worried eyes. Not good? What? It wasn't good? Too much? No, it was the best thing I've ever... I run my hands through my hair. I'm about to... Her mouth opens to an O, and she grins at me, nodding with understanding. Oh... She pauses, then grins at me again. It's okay. I didn't want to. I mean... Still on her knees, she cocks her head. Cass, it felt good? God, yes. Yes, you're... Then come back here. I feel my brows crease, but I take a step forward, and she reaches for my rigid sex, stroking it gently. Cass? I mumble, trying to keep my eyes open while her touch creates a gathering, an awesome tornado of swirling sensation picking up speed inside me. I want you to come in my mouth, she says, clamping her lips over the head of my erection. That's all it takes. I roar my pleasure, the sound starting as a low growl and growing to a sharp clap of animalistic thunder that fills the room. I rise to my tiptoes as I let go, releasing my tribute into her mouth in pulsing jets of unspeakable pleasure that make my ass clench and fingernails draw blood from my palms. With my eyes tightly closed, I don't see her stand up and sit on the side of the bed. But when her fingers thread through mine, I force my eyes open and look down at her. She smiles. Widely, her lips bee-stung and slick in the twilight. Hi, she says, her expression teasing. You're back? It's my turn to drop to my knees in gratitude and reverence, and I do, kneeling before her in absolute devotion and utter fealty. I search her beautiful face, feeling my heart swell so painfully full I almost can't speak. Bryn, I... What? I reach for her face, cradling her cheeks in my palms, staring intently into her eyes, wishing I could tell her how desperately I love her. Thank you. She smiles, twisting her neck slightly to kiss my palm. My pleasure? How do I make you feel like that? I ask. She leans forward and presses her lips to mine, then takes a deep breath. The same way? Still perched on the edge of the bed, she doesn't look away from me as she spreads her legs and lies back. I can smell her scent as I lean my head forward and find I'm anxious to taste her the way she tasted me. Unlike the women in my magazines who are shaved, Bryn has a soft triangle of dark hair at the apex of her thighs. I flatten my hand over it, reveling in the softness before spreading her lips to seek out her clit. Bright pink and glistening, I assume that it will feel as good when my tongue touches it as it did when her tongue touched me. I lean forward and place a gentle kiss on the slick skin, and I am instantly rewarded with a moan of pleasure that sends a bolt of heat from my lips to my groin, making me stiffen all over again. With my shoulders keeping her thighs open, I lap at her sex, reveling in the noises of bliss, moans, whimpers, sighs, and cries that fill the room. When her thighs clamp my shoulders and she screams out my name, her whole body stiffens for a split second before it loses control, writhing in rhythmic ripples as she pants through her orgasm. I lean away from her as the tension in her thighs recedes, and I stand up, looking down at her on the bed. Her head lolls back and forth, and her eyes are clenched, tightly closed. I love her so desperately, I lower myself to the bed, pulling her against my chest and pressing my lips to hers. We taste of each other's most sacred parts blended together, sweet and salty, and a potent reminder of the intimacy we've just shared. We kiss fiercely, our teeth colliding and tongues entwining as I roll her to her back and shift my body over hers, bracing my weight on my elbows so I don't crush her. Her fingers tangle in my hair, pulling sharply, and it brings me back to reality, to the fact that my pecker, throbbing with readiness for her, has lined up at the entrance to her body, and she has raised her knees to welcome me in. Bryn, Angel, wait. Wait for me. I roll off her, my feet landing on the floor with a thud. The plastic bag from the store is in my room, and I race down the hall, grabbing it from my bed and running back to her. When I get back to her room, she's lying on her side, elbow planted on the bed, propping up her head. I wouldn't have stopped, she confesses. I would have kept going. I can't do that, I say, taking a box of condoms from the bag before placing it on the rocking chair. She takes a deep breath and lets it go slowly as she rolls onto her back, staring up at the ceiling. I know. I sense her disappointment, and it makes me hate myself. The last thing I want to do is make her feel anything less than perfect, anything less than beautiful. Placing the condom box on the bedside table, I sit down on the edge of the bed, with my back to her, then look at her over my shoulder. Do you want to stop?
Chapter 27. Bryn. Do I want to stop? No. Am I a little disappointed not to feel him huge and bare inside me? Yes. Did I actually consider letting him come inside me and get me pregnant so we'd never be free of each other? Absolutely. But do I want to stop? Absolutely not. No. I say, sitting up behind him. I spread my legs and press my front flush against his back, wrapping my legs around his waist and my arms around his torso. I lay my cheek against his warm, strong back and say, "That's the thing, Cass. I never want to stop." I know he's been holding his breath because his lungs release in a sigh of relief. "Then help me with this," he says, reaching for the box of condoms and putting a thin foil packet between my fingers. "Turn around." I press a kiss to his back and untangle my legs from his body as he shifts on the bed to face me. His cock stands tall and hard, and my breath catches when I consider that it's been over 2 years since I've had sex. I gulp softly and hope that he's slow and gentle, or that my body remembers how to do this. I don't want it to hurt. That said, I'm also hoping that the blowjob I gave Cass a few minutes ago helps him last, because I've been in a state of intense arousal for days, and I'm dying for release. I stare into his eyes as I raise the packet to my mouth and bite it open with my teeth. Peeling the halves away, I pull out the condom and look back up at him. Ready? For a split second, I wonder if we should talk for a few minutes before he loses his virginity to me. But one look in his eyes tells me that the time for talking is over. This is happening, as soon as possible, and we're both more than ready. He pulls my hand to his cock. I pinch the tip of the condom and cover the strong, slick crest of his erection with latex, using my fingers to roll the sheath over his straining skin. I know you don't want to hear it, I say, placing my hands on his shoulders to sit on his lap, positioning myself over him. But Cassidy, I know, he says, his voice an urgent and strangled whisper as he cuts me off. And I want you to know that if things were different for me, Bryn, If they were different, I swear. His voice trails off as I lower my body onto his, impaling myself on his throbbing sex with a sharp gasp, followed by a blissful sigh. He is big inside me, thick and hot, but I stretch to accommodate him, and we are an exquisite fit. I don't know how he has this much self-control, but his eyes remain open the entire time, thin circles of blue and green framing wide black pupils as he willingly spears me, making me his. If not forever, then definitely for now.
You are,
he murmurs breathily, moving his hips up experimentally as his tongue darts out to wet his lips.
The greatest treasure of my entire life.
Tears collect in my eyes, gathering until his face is a beautiful blur and I feel them course down my cheeks. These words are dear to me, so beloved, in fact, that I clench my muscles around him as hard as I can, willing him deeper, wanting him as close to me as he can possibly be. I wrap my arms around his neck, rocking into him, pressing my breasts against him as he thrusts up again. I am crying and I am laughing at once as he finds a rhythm. To feel such profound love for him in my heart and to feel him, hot and pulsing deep within me, has my climax speeding up, drawing near with every pump of his hips. His erection massages the walls of my sex with every thrust, and I whimper close to his ear, biting blindly until the soft flesh of his lobe is between my teeth. He gasps, then groans, the sound deep and heavy. His hands clasp my hips firmly, careful to avoid my injuries as he thrusts up within me. He is panting against my throat, and I suck on his ear before releasing it. I skim my lips over the smooth skin of his cheek to his mouth, demanding his lips with mine, shifting my hands to cradle the back of his skull and spreading my fingers through his hair. I want this, I whisper in a breathless rush, leaning back to look into his eyes just before my orgasm crashes around me. All I want, Cassidy, is you. I scream in pleasure, tight, frenetic contractions starting in my sex and spreading out all over my body, making me shudder against him as he thrusts up inside me again and again, faster and faster. I am floating. I am limp. I only exist because of the man making passionate love to me.
Bryn,
he cries, his arm clasping me to him like I am his salvation, his only savior, and he calls out my name like it is the only prayer that has ever existed, ever mattered.
Bryn, Bryn, Bryn.
And then he adds, his voice ragged and destroyed,
God, please.
A desperate plea. An anguished, almost despairing entreaty. I don't know why he screams in supplication to God. Maybe for the imminent release that he's never known before this moment. I only know that there is me and there is Cass. And there must be God, too, because only God could have imagined our unlikely pairing. Because only a God who loves us could have led us to each other. His body jerks sharply against mine with a sob before the contractions inside me, filling the condom, become pulsing waves. His forehead falls forward, resting on my shoulder, his lips brushing against my throat mindlessly, instinctively. We are so close. We are one person, our hearts pounding against each other, our bodies still shuddering, though we clutch to one another fiercely, desperately, still intimately joined together. He takes a deep, ragged breath, then groans against my sweaty neck, his breath hot. I have known love in my life, but I have never felt like this before, and I never want to leave the sanctuary of Cassidy's arms. I press my lips to his neck and close my eyes. I love this man, and I am his treasure. I must figure out in the days ahead how to keep us together. It is the only thing that matters now. A week goes by in the blink of an eye. A happy week goes by even faster than that. When I was in college, I kept a diary, and as I longed for whatever boy my heart had seized on, my entries were steady, many and verbose. But when I reread those diaries years later, I noticed a trend. I could tell the moment he looked my way or asked me out, because the entries would cease. During those times, I was too busy to write. I was too happy to pause and evaluate my life in any real way because I'd gotten what I wanted the most and was walking on air for a while. But sooner or later, something would pull me back down to earth, and I'd return to my diary because real life, blunt and heavy, had reemerged. We recognize certain days as the happiest, after all, only because we have something else to compare them with. And because they are finite. Somehow able to suspend my sadness about our eventual separation, I have lived in the moment this week with Cassidy, and these precious days have been the happiest of my life. We have had sex in my bed and in his, on the couch and on the coffee table, in the outdoor shower under the stars, wrapped up in a blanket on Bryn's Rock beside Harrington Pond. We've loved each other's bodies well, reaching for one another at any moment, at all moments, wrapped up around one another until it is impossible to tell where he ends and I begin. We have slept tangled together every night, our dreams mingling, our breath shared, clasping each other until dawn. We've gardened and collected eggs and boiled water to wash our clothes. Our mothers sang the Beatles to us as children, and we sang the same songs to each other while Cass thrums his guitar. And we watch the orange sparks of a campfire ascend to heaven. He's rocked me to sleep while the cicadas chirp their lullaby, and I've traced the peaks and valleys of his face while he sleeps peacefully beside me. All the while, we've ignored the ticking down of the days, letting one run into another. Into another. Almost by tacit agreement, we've managed not to discuss leaving each other. I wonder sometimes if it's slipped his mind. Maybe he hopes it's slipped mine too. But, just as in college, real life always intrudes eventually. My happy days come to a crashing halt on the morning of July 18th. The only way I know that it's July 18th is because my period is like clockwork. When it arrives, I know the date and am suddenly unable to ignore it. There are only 2 days until July 20th, our agreed-on farewell. If I mean to keep my promise to Cassidy, we have only 48 hours left together. He is asleep in my bed, naked in the half-light of dawn, while I sit on the toilet staring down at the pink streaks on the toilet paper. I love him, and I am certain he loves me, though neither of us has said the actual words. I straighten my back. Certainly, we will figure out a way to stay together, won't we? What we have is special. We need to give it a chance. Things like where we live or my job or his dislike of society don't matter as much as our feelings for each other, do they? They shouldn't. They can't. And yet, I remember that he only acquiesced to a relationship with me when I made it clear that it would be temporary and devoid of communicated feelings. But would he give me up now, after so many perfect hours in each other's arms? It breaks my heart to think he would, but another question crowds that one out. Are you ready to give up the life you had before you knew Cassidy? Yes, I think resolutely. I love him. Of course, I would give up anything to be with him. I will sell my house. I will pack up my favorite clothes, put Milo in his carrier, and return to Maine. Return to Cass. I can make a life here. I can be happy as long as I'm with Cassidy. Right? Except. I wipe again, then ball up some toilet paper and slip back into my bedroom, taking a fresh pair of underwear from the bureau and patting the crotch with tissue before pulling them on. I glance at Cassidy, who snores softly, then take a blanket from the foot of the bed and wrap it around my bare shoulders. I slip out the front door and sit in my favorite rocking chair, watching the sun rise over Katahdin and twisting the leather bracelet on my wrist. Except what, Bryn? Except? I miss some of my creature comforts, like my cell phone and satellite TV. I miss plentiful electricity that doesn't depend on sunny days, a generator or a propane tank, and unlimited hot running water that doesn't have to be boiled first. I miss being able to walk down the street to the market and putting a load of clothes in a dryer and having them ready in an hour. I miss movies at theaters. I miss the internet. I miss choosing what kind of music I want to listen to and having it at my fingertips. I miss Amazon Prime. I miss takeout. I don't like my thoughts. I don't want them, but they continue. Though Cassidy is a capable paramedic, his mother died out here without medical care. What if something happened to one of us and we couldn't get to a hospital in time? What if we had a child and the child got sick? Would I ever forgive myself if that child died because we had chosen a lifestyle that imperiled us all? I huddle into the chair and pull the blanket tighter, because daydreams are lovely, uncomplicated things, and crashing back to earth hurts. Are you really ready to give up your life? It's a question I ponder as I stir our clothes in a cauldron of boiling water after lunch, while I let them cool and when I am hanging them on a clothesline one by one. It nags at me while I am cranking the toilet later in the day and taking the refuse to the fertilizer pile. It pops up again when I peruse Cassidy's books before dinner, already knowing the collection by heart. But when I watch him cutting wood and talking gently to Annie and replacing a rotted board on the side of the barn, my fears are trounced. Because I want Cassidy. I want that to my very soul. Maybe what I want, I begin to realize, is Cassidy, but not his entire lifestyle. Would it be possible, I wonder, for us to compromise? For us to blend our lifestyles, to create a new life together? I don't want Cassidy to give up sustainable living, but if we lived on the grid, we could have reliable electricity to power my laptop, a satellite dish, a hot water heater, and other modern amenities. We could still grow fresh vegetables in a garden of our own, but we could also jump in our car or truck and drive to town if we wanted something. Would it be possible to still live a quiet life without being quite so isolated, without being so hidden? Would it be possible to have a place where our privacy was at a premium, but not quite so far away from society? Because that, I think to myself as I wash the vegetables I've harvested today, could be a plan for life. Such a plan makes me feel hopeful and determined, like if Cassidy would just agree to consider it, we could call our shot at happily ever after. I look up as Cassidy opens the front door and walks into the kitchen, leaning against the wall to watch me.
"Those carrots are mighty pretty, Ms. Cadogan," he says.
I grin at him, feeling buoyant, wanting to share my thoughts with him and hoping he likes them as much as I do. "You think so, huh?"
"Uh-huh,"
he says, sauntering over to me. Sexually, he is both instinctive and insatiable, and I've watched his confidence double every day. He knows how to make me come quick and hard with his fingers and mouth. He knows how to hold himself back while he's deep inside me, forcing us both to wait for the intense pleasure of release. He's good at sex. No, for someone who just had sex for the first time a week ago, he's great at it. And I can't get enough of him. His flannel shirt is unbuttoned, showing his tan, washboard abs underneath, and my internal muscles clench. I want him. I always want him, and We are almost finished with our 18 condoms. Yet another reason to be closer to town. Certainly he won't argue with that one. He comes up behind me while I dunk a carrot into the second bucket of water. I use the first to scrub the mud off. The second gets them clean. Set up at the small kitchen table, this system has the unfortunate side effect of getting the table and floor soaked, but it's not a big deal. I'll mop it up when I'm done, and we'll have a delicious, fresh salad with dinner tonight. I pick up another carrot and submerge it in the first bucket, which is brown and cloudy. When I take it out, it's free of mud clumps, but still needs to be rinsed. I switch it to the other bucket, where Cassidy can see my hands in the light tan water, and I rub the carrot suggestively, feeling his eyes on me. He chuckles softly near my ear and reaches for my hips, pulling me back against him, and I can feel his erection bulging through the denim of his jeans. It's straining against his zipper in a bid to get inside me, and that's exactly where I want him to be.
You're giving me ideas, Angel.
Is that right? I ask him, grinning as I pluck another dirty carrot from the pile and rub my ass against his cock.
Heck yes.
I want to talk to him about everything going on in my head, but first I want him to make love to me so we're both relaxed and open. I'm wearing another one of the sundresses I found in the trunk, and my period should still be light enough not to matter. I reach under the skirt for my underwear and bunch them up in the middle as I pull them down, stepping out of them and throwing them under the table. Then I lean forward and reach back again to flip my skirt up so that my ass is bared to him. I hear him hiss through his teeth, and it's one of those visceral, animalistic sounds that makes the moment even hotter. I hear the button of his jeans pop open, followed by the opening of his zipper. My eyes are closed, but I hear the crinkle of a condom packet being pulled from his back pocket and wait as he rolls it on. When his hands land on my hips, I flatten my forearms on the table, spilling more water from the buckets with my movement. Through the sundress, my breasts are instantly soaked, and Cassidy reaches forward, slipping his hands inside the fabric to cup them. His rigid cock strains against the crack in my ass as he flicks my nipples with his fingers, tugging on them, squeezing them, rolling them until they're as hard as he is. "Please, Cass," I beg him, looking over my shoulder and spreading my legs a little wider. I feel him probing for the right place, and then, without warning, he thrusts forward, burying himself to the hilt with one smooth lunge. I cry out, half in surprise and half in pleasure. I am so full of his thick, throbbing flesh, I can barely think of anything except what's going on between us. My fingers grip the table, and I hold on as he withdraws, then pushes back inside. His hands are on my hips, holding me steady, and he pants in ragged puffs that I feel on the back of my neck. Again, he leans away. Again, the slap of skin as he rams his cock inside me, making more water slosh onto the table, cold against my straining nipples. One hand slides from my hip to my pussy, and two fingers find my clit. He massages the turgid butt, pumping into me again and again until my body tenses into one glorious, rigid knot, then explodes with pleasure. He thrusts once more, then stills, holding his breath until he growls my name, coming inside the condom, his hips slowing with his release. The hand holding my hip slips around my waist, and he rests lightly on my back, supporting most of his weight on his feet. His voice is close to my ear when he says between pants,
"Bryn, my angel, my greatest treasure."
He is still deeply embedded inside me. He lives in my heart, and I know, in the most profound reaches of my soul, that he always will. My eyes fill with tears as I rest my cheek on the wet table, and I whisper in total and complete surrender, "I love you, Cass. I want to stay together."
Chapter 28. Cassidy.
I freeze as the words I've simultaneously wanted and dreaded fall from her lips. I love you, Cass. I love you, Cass. I love you, Cass. For one world-stopping moment, I let them sink in. I feel her love for me in the curl of my toes and in the tips of my fingers and with every throbbing beat of my unworthy heart. Then I clench my eyes shut and force myself to reject it, because I love her too. For that reason, more than any other, I cannot accept or return it. Kissing the back of her neck, I lean away from her, carefully withdrawing from her body and turning away to pull off the condom. I tie a knot in the top and throw it in the garbage. I zip up and button my pants, then turn back around to look at her. She is facing me, the front of her dress soaked, her underwear balled up in her hand, her face hopeful and worried at the same time. "I can't take it back," she blurts out, lifting her chin. "Bryn, please." "I need to change," she says quickly, fingering the bracelet she never takes off. "And then we need to talk." I watch her go, the gentle sway of her hips, the soft touch of her bare feet on the floor. She loves me. "Which means she's got to go, Cass. You know who you are, whose son you are. You've lived this fantasy for long enough. It's time to say goodbye." When she comes back to the kitchen, she's dressed in jeans and a tight t-shirt, her feet still bare, her hair back in a ponytail. She stands on the edge of the carpet between the living room and the kitchen, arms crossed over her chest, looking at me with an expression that's breaking my damned heart. "I know I said I wouldn't fall in love with you and that we wouldn't discuss our feelings, but I can't help it. I love you, Cassidy. You're the best man I've ever known, and when I see my future, I see you in it. I want you in it." "Me too, sweet Bryn. I see you in my dreams, too." I clench my teeth. But this has gone far enough. It's time to wake up and face reality. "I've been counting down the days," I lie, resting my palm on the back of a kitchen chair, unable to look her in the eyes. "In 2 days, I drive you back to civilization or we hike out of here. But either way, it needs to end, Bryn. We agreed that..." "No!" she yells, shaking her head as she advances on me, stepping behind the other chair at the table. "No, it's not over. You can't mean that, Cass." "I do mean it," I say, forcing these words to be said because the worst possible fate for my Bryn would be to saddle her with me. "We can't be together. I made that clear from the very..." "Why not?" she cries, slapping her palm on the table. "Maybe you don't love me yet, but you care for me. I know you do. Don't lie to me and tell me you don't, because I know you do, Cassidy." "I can't love you," I yell back at her, running my hands through my hair. I can't. I can't be with anyone. She steps around the chair, closer to me. "Why not? What happened to you? Why did you move out here? Why did your mother die without medical treatment? Where are the pictures of your family? Why do you change the subject whenever I ask about your father? Why can't you love me?" She screams this deluge of questions at me, and they make me tremble because the answers add up to a truth I must conceal. Those answers remind me, fully and thoroughly, of every reason why I can't have Bryn Cadogan. She thinks that if we share our pasts and sort through these questions, we might find answers that will help us. But she's wrong. Answering these questions won't help her figure us out. They'll only confirm what I already know, that there is absolutely no future for us. I stare at her, my jaw clenched and my eyes burning. She takes another step toward me, within reaching distance now, and gentles her voice when she speaks. "I don't care what happened," she sobs, with tears running down her face. "The past doesn't matter. Only now. I want to be with you. I love you. Just the way you are." She takes a ragged breath, reaching for my arm, but I step back instinctively out of her reach. Her touch, which I crave, could shatter my resolve, and I can't allow that to happen.
"Please, Cass."
"No." My tears are getting the better of me, so I look away from her, dropping my gaze to the floor in misery.
"Cassidy,"
she whimpers. "It's just not possible," I grind out softly.
"Please," she begs, "please listen. We could get a little place closer to town, but with lots of privacy. We could have a, a life together, read and make love. We could have a couple of kids and...
A couple of kids, a couple of kids, a couple of kids. The words clang around in my head like bullets fired into a metal barrel, and I can't breathe, because having children would be wrong, would be evil, would be breaking old promises that are still essential and must be kept. Everything in me rebels against what she's saying, and a swirling storm of panic whirls up. My fists ball at my sides in protest, and she's still standing in front of me, talking about little places and privacy and children. Everything I want so goddamned desperately and can never have. The world is spinning too fast and there isn't enough time, and I hate who I am, and I hear a roar of anguish rise from inside me. No! I bellow at the top of my lungs, advancing on her like a maniac as she stops talking. Never, ever, ever! I raise my shaking fist and hold it in front of me. Shut up! She gasps, her eyes widening in fear, and lunges backward, away from me, her feet stepping in a puddle on the floor. I watch as she tries, almost in slow motion, to regain her balance, but she can't. She slips and falls, crying out as her wrist slams to the floor first, breaking her fall. She screams, then whimpers, curling into herself on the floor and cradling her wrist against her chest as she sobs. I am standing over her. I am standing over my beloved broken girl with fisted hands while she cries. And suddenly time and space flex and loosen, and I feel the spirit of my father pass through me. And in that split second, I know that there were many, many times that he stood over a woman he had just hurt, watching her cry. Just like me. Just like him. What I have always dreaded, always feared, is happening, is coming true. I am turning into him. I blink at her lying there on the floor, my heart racing, my lungs unable to fill. I can't breathe. I can't look away. I am so filled with horror and revulsion and self-hate, I want to die. It was only a matter of time. My fingers unfurl and my hands are shaking uncontrollably. I want to reach for her, to help her, to bandage her wrist and apologize for frightening her, for yelling at her, but I don't trust myself. If I am turning into my father next time, I might do worse than just raise my fist. I might actually use it. The best thing I can do, the only thing I can do, is leave her, put as much distance as possible between her and me. I leap over her huddled body, bolt out the front door barefoot, into the dark night, and start running. It's a while before I stop, and I do only because my feet don't have calluses sufficient for running through the woods at night. They are cut up and bleeding from rocks and twigs and uneven ground. They hurt. I deserve it. I don't know where that violent, beastly scream came from, but I know it scared her enough to cause her to slip and fall and hurt herself. I know I am the cause of her injury, and I hate myself for it. I'm not sure where I am, but I was going southeast, toward Baxter Park, when I left the house, so I assume I've come up on Dacey Pond at this point. I wade in, letting my feet squish into the cold mud. It eases the sharp physical pain in my soles, but nothing can lessen the anguish in my heart. I have hurt someone. For the first time in my quiet life, I have hurt someone. And worst of all, I have hurt someone I love. Looking up at the dark sky, I consider my options now. Not that she still wants me after what I did, but I definitely don't trust myself around her now. If she should mention being together, or, God forbid, having children who might inherit and carry the genes of my insane father, I can't guarantee that I won't lose it again. My God, I raised my fist to her. If she'd kept talking, would I have actually hit her? I feel sick at the thought. I want to believe that nothing could ever lead me to harm her, but I know what lives inside me. I don't, I cannot trust myself. Live quiet, and no matter what happens inside of you, you won't never be able to hurt someone, Cassidy. It's what your mama would want. Gramps' words come back to me, as right and true as the day he said them. I allowed Bryn to get too close to me. I allowed myself to get too close to her. I have put her in jeopardy. The very thought makes me sob. Tears stream down my face as I throw my head back and scream to the dark, unforgiving heavens. I'm sorry. I'm so goddamned sorry. A drop of water plops on my forehead. It's joined by another and another and another, dotting my face and wetting my shirt, mixing with my tears and washing me clean. And the answer comes to me quickly. To keep her safe, send her away. If you love her, let her go. There is redemption only through action. There is peace only through righteousness. I know what I have to do. I take my time hiking back to the homestead because I need Bryn to be asleep when I get there. Gramp kept a glass bottle of ether in the root cellar, mostly for the animals. He'd use it if they were injured or once for a cow during the breech birth of her calf. At the end of her life, when Mama was in terrible pain and the fentanyl prescribed by her doctor wasn't helping anymore, Gramp would apply a bit of ether to a rag and set it over her nose and mouth so she could sleep easier. I know how to use it. Bryn must leave, and she can't come back looking for me. I need to get her away from me, somewhere safe, as soon as possible. On its own, a fight in the kitchen like ours, an intense emotional conflict between an otherwise loving young couple, might not warrant more than cursory concern. In fact, between two normal people, such anger without name-calling, threats, or actual physical violence might even be chalked up to passionate argument. But I am not normal. Now that it's begun, it's only a matter of time before my behavior will escalate, and Bryn must be far away from me when that happens. My plan is to use the ether to drug her while she sleeps so she stays unconscious, bundle her up in a blanket on my lap, and drive her to Millinocket under cover of night. I'll find somewhere safe to leave her, and then I'll return home to start packing up. I'll shut up my house as best I can and disappear into the wilderness. I will find somewhere else to live quiet, and this time I won't allow myself to diverge from that course. And if the madness gets bad enough, I gulp with the heaviness of my thoughts. Then I will take my own life. When I get home, I detour to the barn, then head to the house. It's quiet, and the clock in the tidy kitchen reads 1:10. I move soundlessly across the living room carpet to Bryn's room and step through the doorway. I swallow back the meager contents of my stomach when I see the state of her room and my sweet girl. She is sleeping on her side, tissues littering the floor by the bed, her wrist wrapped in a dish towel. Hurt and sad, she must have cried herself to sleep, and my heart aches with love and sorrow and regret. It never, ever should have come to this. You did this to her. You, Cassidy. My fingers tighten around the ether bottle and rag by my side. Now do what's right. Make it right. So I do. It's a slow ride from my place into Millinocket, and it takes a little over 2 hours. The roads are mostly empty. They're often quiet anyway. But from 2 to 4 on a weekday morning, almost no one is around, which is good. I know where the police station is from my very occasional visits to town. It's behind the post office, where Gramp used to collect his government checks. My plan is to park close by and carry Bryn to the entrance. I'll leave her there and drive home. When I stop to quad in the far corner of the parking lot, near the road, I don't see anyone around. Bryn hasn't stirred much during our trip, though I've redosed her twice just to be sure she didn't wake up. I stopped feeling my arms halfway through the trip since she was lying across my lap. Now I cut the engine, looking down at her face. I love you, I wish I could say. And if things were different, I'd love you forever, my sweet angel. Thank you for giving me the happiest days of my sorry life. Thank you for seeing the good in me when I know there is so much bad deep inside. Thank you for loving me when I was certain I'd spend the rest of my life unloved. I promise, I give you my most sacred vow that I will never come looking for you again. I will leave you alone to find happiness. I will leave you alone so that I know you're safe. You are and will forever be my life's greatest treasure. And I will still be loving you on the day I die, Bryn Cadogan. I clutch her against me, clenching my leaking eyes closed as I lean my forehead against hers and breathe her in one final time. Don't come looking for me, I beg her. If I ever see you again, I'll never be able to let you go. I gather her into my arms and stand up, pressing my lips to her forehead and holding them there for a long moment. It is a certain kind of death march as I walk slowly across the dark parking lot to the nondescript brick building before me, because my life will be colorless and loveless when I leave her and go.
But still my feet move forward in their labor, because I love her, and I suspect my descent into madness has already begun. Finally, I am near the door, where I find a bench. I can place her on it, and she'll be just to the left of the police station door. Someone will find her quickly, or when she wakes up, she'll figure out where she is right away. Certainly no one will bother her this close to the station entrance. It's my best chance at leaving her somewhere safe. Standing behind the back of the bench, I lower her gently before taking a step away. To my right, there is a bulletin board, and a notice behind the glass catches my eye. Tip line open. Missing woman / dead man. The Millinocket Police Department is seeking information about the disappearance of a woman from the Chimney Pond Trail on June 19th. In conjunction, police seek information regarding the stabbing death of a man found in an Appalachian Trail lean-to 1/4 mile west of the Chimney Pond Ranger Station on June 21st. Events possibly related. Any details can be forwarded to the MPD. My held breath burns my lungs as I read and reread the notice once, twice, three horrifying times. It cannot be a coincidence. Bryn is the missing woman. Wayne, her attacker, is the dead man. My mind flashes back to that afternoon, to hearing Bryn scream, to finding Wayne stabbing her, to throwing him across the lean-to where he remained unconscious until I left with her. No, not unconscious. Dead. Oh my God, no. I killed him. I killed a human being. Bryn stirs in her sleep, whimpering softly, but I turn away from her and I don't look back. I turn over my quad and zoom out of the parking lot like the devil's on my heels. She will be safe now, and that's all that matters. As for me, I am damned. I am a murderer now, just like my father.
Chapter 29. Bryn. I don't know where I am. I just know that I'm not in bed because it's hard and cold. If I was in bed, Cassidy would be keeping me warm. I blink my eyes open and try to orient myself, but I have no idea what I'm looking at. Pushing myself into a sitting position, I realize that I'm fully dressed, outdoors on a bench beside a red brick building. Where the hell am I? As I twist my head to look around, it throbs like crazy and I wince, pressing my fingers to my temples. What happened? The last thing I remember is crying myself to sleep after our fight. Our terrible fight in the kitchen when I pressured Cassidy to imagine a life with me, and he rejected me without exception, then left me hurting and alone on the floor. A sob rises in my throat, but I swallow it back. My head aches and my eyes burn. I have no idea where I am, but hysterics won't help me figure it out. I reach for my wrist and find it wrapped carefully with an aced bandage. My braided bracelet moved to my other wrist. Did Cassidy do that while I was sleeping? Did he bring me to town to have it checked out? Surely not. He treated my stab wounds himself. Where is he? Cass, I call weakly, looking around at the parking lot behind me. There are only 3 cars parked and no ATV. I look up at the sky, noting that the sun is on the rise. I'm guessing it's about 6 o'clock. The world is still waking up. Cassidy, I call again, standing up. This is when I realize I have shoes on. I haven't worn shoes in weeks, so the hiking boots I wore to hike Katahdin feel heavy and confining on my feet. I didn't even realize that Cassidy had saved them, but feeling them on my feet feels wrong, feels like bad news that I don't want to hear. I scan the parking area for Cassidy's ATV because there's no other way I could have gotten here. But I don't see him. I don't hear the quad's motor nearby, either. Looking down, I realize there is a note pinned to my shirt, and I unpin it, holding it up. Sweet Bryn, this was the only way. You asked if I love you, and the answer is yes, so much that I have to let you go. You will always be my treasure, and I will never, ever forget you. But you are better off without me, I promise. For both our sakes, please don't come looking for me. Cass. P.S. Your wrist is sprained. Ice it when you wake up. I inhale sharply, my fingers shaking as I read and reread the short message, its stark and horrible meaning sinking in. I stare at the beautiful, ruthless letters that have severed my life from his. He loves me, but he has gone to drastic measures to keep us apart, and it rips my heart in two. He's left me here. He's gone. My stomach clenches and my knees weaken, forcing me back down on the bench. I lean forward on my knees, afraid I'm going to be sick.
Miss? Miss? I just seen you out here. Can I help you?
I turn to look behind me. I see a glass door being held open by a portly, uniformed officer.
Miss, are you okay?
No. No, I am not okay. Not at all. I don't know. Where am I?
You're in Millinocket, Maine, at the police station, he says,
gesturing to the words on the door.
Why don't you come on in? I have a pot of hot coffee brewing.
No, I have to find... Who? Cassidy? No, Bryn, Cassidy's gone. No matter how much he claims to love you, it wasn't enough to want a future with you.
Miss, you don't look too good. What's your name?
Bryn Cadogan?
Bryn Elizabeth Cadogan.
I nod, distracted from the pain in my heart by the fact that this person knows my middle name.
Well, good Lord, he says,
opening the door a little wider.
We've been looking everywhere for you.
For me?
Oh, yeah, miss. For you.
I tilt my head to the side and walk into the small police department, watching as he opens a leaf in the countertop and rounds the counter to sit behind the desk.
Bryn Cadogan, your parents been sick about you. They've been staying over at the Ferguson Lake Lodge on Route 11, been up that mountain about 100 times looking for you, don't you know?
My parents, I gasp. They're here?
Aye, at the Ferguson Lake Lodge.
How long have they been here?
2 weeks? 3, maybe? Don't know exactly, but we see Colin and Jenny least every other day. They come by looking for leads.
The officer cocks his head.
If you don't mind my asking, what in Sam Hell happened to you?
I place my palms on the reception desk between us, my fingers white and rigid. I was hiking Katahdin a few weeks ago. I was attacked in an AT lean-to.
Yup.
He nods, like he knows, unaccountably, that this is so.
On June 19.
That's right. I rub my forehead, the bruising headache getting worse, and my stomach still roiling, though I haven't eaten anything since lunch yesterday. I was, a little bit west of the Chimney Pond Saddle Merge when a man named Wayne attacked me.
Huh,
he murmurs, squinting his eyes and pursing his lips like something isn't quite adding up.
You say his name was Wayne?
Yes, Wayne. He stabbed me. I hear the front door open behind me, and the officer I'm speaking to makes eye contact with someone over my shoulder.
Morning, Marty. I think you're going to want to hear this.
Hear this. Another officer, dressed in street clothes and slightly younger than the first, opens the leaf in the counter and faces me. He looks me over, his brown eyes keen, before nodding slowly.
Bryn Elizabeth Cadogan,
he says, staring at my face. Yes, sir.
Where you been?
The first officer clears his throat and nods.
Go ahead and tell Marty what you just told me.
I was attacked on the saddle trail, a little ways up from the Chimney Pond Merge. I had skinned my knee and wanted to bandage it up. I stopped in at a lean-to and the relentless rain, Wayne's smile, Want me to take a look-see at your kneesy? It all comes rushing back, and the room spins, so I clench my eyes shut.
Take your time,
says Marty.
Lou, get her a cup of water, eh?
I take a deep, shaking breath and open my eyes. There was a man there, named Wayne. He threw me against the wall, and he... My hand falls to my hip. He stabbed me. He stabbed me 6 times. Marty tilts his head to the side, then rubs his chin.
Wayne, you say?
Wayne, I nod, twisting the braided bracelet that Cassidy gave to me. He said his name was Wayne.
Huh.
Marty is perched on the side of Lou's desk with a cup of coffee in one hand and a laptop bag on his other shoulder. He points to a nondescript gray metal desk a few feet behind him.
I think we better sit down to sort this out. Come with me, miss?
He opens the leaf in the counter, and I follow him to his desk. He gestures to a beat-up, padded chair, and I sit down, gratefully taking the cup of water that Lou offers. I take a sip, letting the coolness sluice down my throat, and suddenly my eyes fill with tears. Cassidy brought me here. He left me here. He is gone and believes I am better off without him, even though he loves me. Even after I told him I loved him. Even though we love each other, he isn't willing to give us a chance. A sudden pain in my chest makes me cover my heart with my palm. I whimper softly, and I think I'm going to be sick. I close my eyes, leaning my chin on my chest.
Just breathe a minute, miss, says Marty. I'll get some fresh air in here.
I hear the sound of a window opening, and suddenly the sounds of humanity fill the room. The hum of a car engine, the footfalls of a jogger, the buzz of a cell phone. I am so far from Cassidy now. He has abandoned me here. I am all alone. Your parents been sick about you. They've been staying over at the Ferguson Lake Lodge on Route 11. As tears roll down my face, I am overwhelmed with a longing to see my parents. I want my mom and dad.
Of course. But first, Miss Cadogan, we really need to hear your story, says Marty, sitting back down at the desk. Do you think you could just tell me what happened out there?
I take a deep breath and look up. And then I can go see them.
After we get your statement, I'll drive you over there myself.
He clicks the top of a pen and positions it over a notepad.
Let's go back to that day. You were hiking the AT.
Not the AT. Just Katahdin.
Alone?
No, I shake my head. With a group, at first. 2 girls from Williams. They turned back because of the rain.
But you kept going.
I gulp, remembering the girls trying to get me to go back with them. At the time, I was determined to keep walking for Jem. And if I hadn't, I never would have met Cass. My broken heart weeps. Will I ever see Cass again?
Miss Cadogan, you kept walking, and then what?
The rain was coming down hard, and I slipped. I skinned my knee.
Then what? Take your time.
We had met a man named Wayne at Roaring Brook. He was aggressive with us, called us names. He was... You're just tourists in my dreams. I shake my head. He was off. We knew he was off from the start. Something wasn't right about him, and we sensed it. He wanted to hike with us, but we said no, and he got angry. And then these guys from...
Bennington College.
Asks Marty. My neck jerks up, and I search his face. Yeah, Bennington. How did you...
We've talked to them a few times. Them and the girls. They were the last to see you that day.
He grimaces.
You skinned your knee. What happened next?
I saw the lean-to through the rain, so I walked over to it, thinking I could patch up my knee and wait out the storm, but... Wayne was... Well, if it ain't Grandma. My heart is racing like crazy. Oh God, I sob, the events of that terrible day closing in around me.
Slow down now, says Marty. Easy. Breathe in.
I close my eyes and take a deep breath, opening them as I exhale.
That's right, says Marty. Now go back to this Wayne.
Yes, Wayne. He drank some tea and alcohol. Scotch, I think. He was still angry that we didn't let him walk with us. He threw me against the wall and
he stabbed you.
My hand has moved to my hip, and I slide up my shirt a little, looking down at two of the pink scars that are still healing. 6 times.
All we ever found was your backpack. Nothing else, says Marty. How'd you fight him off?
I didn't. I was dying.
How'd you get away?
Asked Lou, who was standing behind Marty, staring at me intently. I was saved, I whisper, bowing my head as tears stream down my cheeks.
By who?
I look up at the officers and gulp over the lump in my throat. A man named Cassidy Porter. Marty and Lou snap their necks around to face each other so fast, I'm surprised I don't hear twin cracking sounds.
Porter,
confirms Lou, eyeing me like I've said something completely crazy. I nod. Cassidy Porter. Marty clears his throat, leaning away from me, his face a mixture of disbelief and confusion. He looks down at his notepad, then back up at me, tapping his pen between his fingers.
Let me be sure I got this straight. You say you were attacked by a guy named Wayne and rescued by a guy called Cassidy Porter?
Yes, I whisper, looking at Marty's stunned expression.
Miss Cadogan,